On today's 15 with the Author, I talk with Cindy Suarez, author of The Power Manual, How to Master Complex Power Dynamics. She's been working with nonprofits and activists for 20 years. Cindy is a journalist and a consultant in nonprofit management. In her new book, she explores the major concepts of power with a focus on how to shift power dynamics to create change both personally and professionally. Welcome to the show, Cindy.
Thank you, Terry. Thanks for having me.
That seems like a tall order.
Yes. You know? It is a very ambitious book, but, you know, these times call for such opportunities. I mean, it's just a time of lots of change, and I think it's pushed me to really think about the source of power and narratives and how central those are to the way that the world we create, the way that we interact and what we create. And I think when we're in a situation like we are now where there's just so much conflict and it's just the new norm, mm-hmm. it people are really looking, as I was when I started writing this, for a different way of being in the world.
And there really are power struggles in nearly everything we do.
Yes.
Nearly every interaction, and they've always been there, but it does seem it is definitely much more intensified now. And, you know, as our country's divided, and that seems to lend itself to creating even more harsher power struggles.
Yes, I think they do both. I mean, I think. You know, and there's a section in the book on transformational spaces and what are they, and they happen in everyday life, but they also happen over phases in history. And I think that what those are, it's important to understand those spaces, first of all, that we kind of go between spaces where things are really structured and, you know, they kind of flow for a while on a certain status quo. And then things begin to shift, and when those ruptures become really big, those moments of change actually are really high leverage moments to both understand and you know, the phases of them and how one moves through those spaces. How is that part of life or the dynamic of evolution structured? And I think that it's a moment where the new structure, it hasn't emerged yet. The old one no longer works so well, and the new one hasn't emerged, and there's actually a battle for the next structure. So I think they're both moments where things can be really intensified and made harsher for many people, and also, if grasped, moments where fundamental changes can happen towards a different space, one that perhaps is more mutual and more fair and equitable and just.
And do you see this as, you know, we're in the 50th year of 1968, very tumultuous year, the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. And I just actually talked with his daughter, Carrie Kennedy, who came out with a book, Ripples of Hope. And what's interesting is that my question would be, is there a cyclicalness to this, if that's a word?
To like hope, and then it's like time of threat,
for the power struggles. Is there a wave of things that happen cyclically, sort of like the seasons to a very small extent?
Yes, I think so, and I think that's sort of what I was saying just now about the spaces in our history where things seem pretty ordered and there's at least an order that we agree to, and then where things are fundamentally being questioned. And I do think that those are different. Victor Turner was an anthropologist, did a lot of work to shine a light on that part of life, that part of a time period. And what he found is that those spaces are really different. There are spaces where there's also a lot of potentiality, is what he says. In those spaces, all of the parts that didn't get to really live in the previous order are still there. And so things are kind of jumbled up again, and things that where they're underneath can come back up, as we're seeing, things that maybe weren't resolved but were for a moment agreed upon. This is the way that the U.S., for example, is going to work for the next 20 or 30 years. Not that anyone thought that, but I think as those rights and those kind of ways that came out of the 60s, late 60s, the kind of changes that we saw, as those both matured and the backlash against those changes matured, we got to having in, for example, civil society and social movement space, a proliferation of, and not just in those spaces, really all over the world, a proliferation of multiplicity, of multiple identity, of things becoming ever more complex. And at the same time, you have the backlash against that, where things that people thought were no longer part of our psyche kind of reemerge with a lot of power. I think they're cyclical. I think that, you know, they emerge mm-hmm. and sort of they're very vibrant. And it really shows you how that vibrancy and understanding that shows, at least to me, points to how much there is to work with. And I think that's important to remember, where we sometimes feel that the structures of power or the leaders of power just have so much power. Really, the power is in the dynamism between these kind of ideas and the people that try to bring them to life.
Mm-hmm. So definitely the word hope is a strong word and is living and well.
Yeah, I mean, you mean a strong word in the zeitgeist right now?
I mean a strong word in that it's a powerful word.
Yes, and I think more than hope for me, it's faith. It's one of the things that I really felt in the writing of this book and in the exploration of it. I felt it strengthened in me, this idea of understanding the full nature of power and my access to it and the different places and the knowledge that I can build over time continuously really gave me a feeling of faith. I mean, not in a way that I don't see the, you know, what's possible on any side, but a faith that, you know, if people understood and could really engage and understand their power, that things could really also be more wonderful.
Yeah,
I hope. I have children,
hopeful.
So
yeah,
I hold on to that.
Yes. We're talking with Cindy Suarez. She is the author of The Power Manual, How to Master Complex Power Dynamics. And I guess, are there types of power?
I'm sorry. Are there types of power? I begin the book in the first chapter differentiating between dominant power and liberatory power. And that's the distinction at the rest. I'm sorry.
And what is liberatory power? I don't know that word.
Yeah, so dominant power is what we all tend to really recognize as power and to not understand that there are other ways of exercising power, but it's basically power over others. Liberatory power, on the other hand, is the power to create the world that you want, not through taking from others, but through generating and interacting in ways that amplify power. So they're very different. The book really distinguishes between those and really spends a lot of time with many frameworks and tools to really dig deep into that. But that's the premise of the book, that there are two different types of power at least.
And language can be used both to empower and usurp power.
Oh, yeah, it's one of the key ways.
And how would someone handle that?
Well, really, I think the way they would handle any other way that language, domination or power is exerted, because it's exerted physically, it is exerted mm-hmm. even what is accepted as a reality from which to even begin to speak or move within. So there are all many levels, but I think I'm sorry, your question again about that specifically was?
How would someone handle that? In a smaller context, not the greater space, but two people are having a conversation and, you know, we talk about the war of words, or we talk about, some people, they have a lot of college education, where somebody else is a blue-collar worker, and there is sometimes a... The language that they use may not be understood to each other.
Yes, it's true. Wow, that works on a lot of levels. And I think part of it, I mean, just to get to the core of it, I think the central structure of how to become more knowledgeable about this is to understand that there are signs of power and understand what those signs are. And that comes from semiotics, and it's a whole field, but it really is to understand when somebody says something, when somebody moves a certain way, when somebody frames something this way, it is a type of power, or it is this key part that upholds power, status quo relationships. And, you know, that's a really high level, but the whole book is about that. It's describing that. It's saying what are the different levels, and how does it show up in family, how does it show up in schools, how does it show up when you talk, when you, you know, move through a space. And so, you know, that's the whole premise. But I think there are many ways to understand it. And to me, it's almost like when you really look at that part of the world, which seems invisible, you don't at first even know what the signs of power are. This is actually pretty clear. It's not as subjective as it may sound. The signs of power repeat. There are patterns in a society that show up in different ways. So first is understanding the signs of power, and then understanding the relationship between the different signs and sort of the narratives that they uphold. And then it's using those same, you know, words or relationships or concepts to create a new story that's more mutual. And so there are many ways that can happen. And it's funny, I just had an example of that the other day, and I'm hoping I can remember, because it's actually sometimes easier to just give an example, which is why I try to do that throughout the book.
One example that I have, and it wasn't necessarily using language, but many years ago, I've always worked in fields that were dominated by men. Another instance where I was, the power shifted, was actually my indifference. I had been asking for a substantial raise, as I deserved it, being paid less than my male counterparts. Once I stopped being concerned about whether they would let me go and said, that's what I want, period, that's it, I got it.
It's so true. It's so funny that you say that, because I've actually had a few conversations this past few weeks with friends who, you know, friends come to you with challenges such as these, you know. And in all the instances, I was just recalling this morning with my daughter, it took a lot of time for me, and sometimes with one of these friends, having three conversations over a period of a week to get to the point, because it was actually a negotiation, business negotiation with a partner. And the whole time I was trying to get to, what do you really want? What do you really want? What do you really want? And he kept telling me what he would accept, or what, you know, what he could live with. And it took me a while, not till the third time, that I said, you know what I'm hearing you say is that what you really think is fair is this. And he said, yeah, I actually do. And then we started talking about why did he go to the place where immediately he conceded. And we talked about growing up and what it was like to be a working class person. And this person is white, so these identities are very complex. And this happens over and over again, really, as soon as you... The point is to figure out what you really want. And that's, like, you have to almost always redirect your attention there, because part of power, and when it becomes internalized, is that it, the ultimate form of power, which I talk about in the book, is that it shapes desire. So being in touch with your desire, your true desires, not the ones that you may be in touch with, is actually a work in process. I mean, for me, it took me years to tap into it in terms of deep life, sort of reoriented my whole career. But it's very important, and it's not easy, and it should not be taken lightly.
Well,
tapping into your desires is actually a really key part of the work of liberation.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things that you say, have in your book is about refusing powerless identities.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's where it starts. And I think that's what was really fascinating for me when I really tracked the research that I had accumulated over the years. What I found, because this was me putting together lots of ideas that shaped me, and then putting those ideas together and really mapping the thinking behind those ideas and why did they impact me, and what was the cohesive story. And what I found was this sub-story across all these different areas. And the first one was identity, that really it starts with how we perceive ourselves in an interaction. Many of us, through our upbringing, and especially as a child, learn our power relationship. You know, we learn whether when we make demands on the world around us and the environment, whether it will be engaged or not. But that teaches you a key, I mean, that happens when you're two, when a child asks for something. Does that child get it? Does that child get to negotiate to get it? Does that child get told no right away? Does that child get punished for asking? So all of those, I mean, you can imagine there are many different lives that can flow from just that one initial experience. You get a sense of how deep it goes. And a lot of the work, and actually in a lot of the sort of counseling that I do, and I don't really work as a counselor, but I find a lot of people come to me with these sort of questions. Oftentimes you know, the question I ask at the beginning after I hear is, where's your power in this? Like, where is the place where you have power in this story? And for many people, there's like this kind of like a jump, like, oh wow, I never thought of it that way. And that's what I love, the idea that just a powerful idea or question can really trigger a whole new way of being in the world to even begin exploring that. So I actually had a coworker that this happened with, and I said, well, where's your power in this situation? Because this other person was creating a really hard environment for her. And she had a really hard time, and she said, wow, that's a really powerful question. I'm going to think about that. And then she came back and said, you know, I'm not really ready to take my power right now. And I said, okay.
Yeah.
And then she worked towards being able to get it. So it's just kind of like the magic of understanding the words, you know, the power of words to really allow us to imagine and to create and to, and that's just all part of the work of looking at these things and of really thinking about what we want and where's our power in that.
And it's interesting too, because I'm a 57-year-old white woman, and I encountered male dominance as a factory worker. I was a factory worker for 11 years. When I started at 18, also small, I was challenged all the time. The men would make the job harder for me, stacking in things that I couldn't reach. And, you know, I knew I could do the job. I just had to approach it differently. So I actually took a broomstick and started knocking down what I needed because they'd stacked it too high, and knocking it down, and then it'd fall to the ground, and then I'd pick it up and I'd do what I was supposed to do.
Uh-huh.
And it didn't take too long till they just stopped stacking that stuff too high for me.
Well, that's awesome. It seems like you really know how to find your power in a situation.
Every once in a while, I score.
I mean, it's so awesome because, I mean, the world is full of people, and we're all making demands on each other as we move to the world, and learning how to, like, bump up against that and sort of, like, take up your space and not really take too much of other people. It's an art.
And I think that's an important piece that you just pointed out is, you know, finding a balance so that we're not taking over somebody else's power, but moving together to create something even more powerful.
Right. And I think part of it is that, and I talk about this in the book, that there are fundamental different approaches around resources, and that in a liberatory sort of framework, the assumption is abundance, and that's actually the reality of the universe. The universe is a place of abundance. It's not a space of scarcity.
Mm-hmm.
We impose scarcity and create scarcity, but that's not its natural state. So it's really important to, as we look through these frameworks, you kind of see, because they make sense. They're part of nature. They're part of what we know to be true. And in a time like now, tapping into what's really true is important.
And I think makes me think about what we call the power of the press.
Yeah.
And that's long been established, but as it is now, it's being fundamentally challenged by the president. What are the public to garner from that?
You know, it's interesting you say that, because in my job at Nonprofit Quarterly, where I'm a senior editor, and we cover with the leading journal for the nonprofit sector, and I've started to really focus on narratives. And what I notice, I actually just finished a piece today, and what I notice, and I look at trends, and I look at the stories and how they're being covered, and I'll take a set of stories and talk about the narratives that the reporters are using. And so what I'm finding over and over again is that a lot of reporters, and I'm not just talking, I mean, I listen to mostly public radio, that they're actually, we need to deepen our understanding about how to talk about power, because it's no longer a logical conversation. That's an objective conversation based on facts.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a deeper conversation about truth and about narrative and about how to dig at sort of manipulative type of conversations. Mm-hmm. Like how. So I find I'm fascinated whenever I'm listening to a story and I hear the, because I'm in my car listening to a story, and I hear the signs of power, and I'm thinking, and as an interviewer, I listen to what the reporter actually asks, and oftentimes those are the moments where the reporter is upset because they know that the that the person they're interviewing is being slippery with their language and on purpose, and there isn't a way to really address that unless you understand and can name what's happening at a higher level. And I think that's, you know, a big thing, a big skill, I think, that press in general, we all need to sort of up. I mean, I think we've really tried to focus on telling the truth, but when the truth itself is being questioned or posed as multiple truths, then we need to really be able to...
I said manipulated. When the
We're beyond language that has reason and logic and even good intention. We are in the space of manipulative language, and we need to understand that and call it out in an interview in a way that dismantles that process as it's happening. So what I do when I see those is I write about those. I just wrote a piece today. I've written a few, and I'm fascinated with that. So I think for the press right now, the work is to really understand how power shows up in narrative and how that affects interviews.
Yeah,
so that people who listen can understand that. I mean, if the press is able to do that, by extension, many other people will, because the stories would just be shaped differently.
Right.
So, for example, there was one of the stories that I'm covering is the story of the white as minority, given the new census reports that are coming out. And I was writing about this perception of whites as minority and how the whole story, even though the person was critiquing this, the whole story was how white people respond to demographic changes over the next few decades will play a large part in how we go through this transition as the U.S. becomes more diverse racially. And I said, well, imagine the story was as more people of color become, non-subordinate or more in equal footing, how does that shape the conversation? So even in questioning white dominance, the question starts with how it affects and how whites will shape the transition of white dominance.
That's interesting.
So it's just so, it's actually really, I would say fun. It is fun because it's this narrative that you can understand if you really know how to look for those signs of power and to analyze them and then to know what to do. And I think that to me is such a source of power.
Yeah. We are talking with Cindy Suarez. She is the author of the... I just made a mess. that's a good thing that was water. The Power Manual, How to Master Complex Power Dynamics. And I guess one last question, we running over a little bit here, fascinating conversation, but as you were writing the Power Manual, what was your biggest takeaway?
Oh, that it is not an easy thing to be free, that it is not for the faint of heart, that it is really a discipline. It is a discipline to be free.
Yeah.
No one can give it to you.
Interesting. That's wow. That's powerful right there. Well, Cindy, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it. Again, the book is The Power Manual, How to Master Complex Power Dynamics. And wish you the best. Is there another book coming?
I am actually thinking about this next one. I have a few, but I have one that I'm actually really thinking about seriously.
All right. Well, then we will probably have another conversation.
Great. I look forward to it, Terry.
All right. Thanks, Cindy.
Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.